young people from belief in God to disbelief. And I think we can see that in the media and how they talk about dinosaurs today. So I take an interest in dinosaurs because I want to do everything I can to keep our young people from being deceived about where they came from. And because dinosaurs are being used by many people to direct them in another way, I have particular interest in doing otherwise. So what I'm going to do tonight, I'm going to show you a short video which talks about our project and just gives you a little introduction into where we are and what we do, and then I'm going to take you through the experience that we have as we work out there every summer in the month of June. So if we can have the lights out and see if we can get that a video to play.
There are perhaps 10 to 20,000 animals that have been buried across this extensive bone bed of dinosaur fossils.
I decided I have to commit myself to saving as much of this information as I can. The Dinosaur Research Project started out in the middle 1990s as a result of a call that I received from a vertebrate paleontologist. He invited me to go out with him to Wyoming and look at this amazing site. And when I got there, I tried to step out of the truck. There were dinosaur bones all over the ground.
Southwestern has been involved since 1997, and then in 1999, there was a class that was taught with two or three students, and from then, it's grown.
We go to Wyoming each June and spend a month there excavating the remains of these dinosaurs.
Southwestern offers a four-credit lab science course that students can take. They learn what the project is all about, and they're contributing to a valuable scientific research project. Most of what they do is the excavation, working in the quarries, finding bones, exposing them. They're learning the techniques.
These students will take these bones once they've been prepared and curate them into the collection.
I take the bones, put them on the turntable, and photograph them as they go around. And then I Photoshop them and add them to the computers so that they have a 360-degree view. So anyone can get onto the catalog and just watch them.
The research we're doing is primarily taphonomic. Taphonomy covers everything from what the dinosaurs were doing when they died, how they died, what happened after they died. It's a pretty comprehensive study, very much like crime scene investigation.
We use high-precision surveying equipment that's GPS-based so that we can make multiple measurements on each fossil to determine their location in three dimensions to within a centimeter. And that way we can then use the computer to reconstruct a virtual quarry. With that, we can look at the distribution of bones, and that may tell us something about how they happened to come to that location.
A number of other activities besides digging up dinosaur bones. And one of the highlights of the trip for many students is the spiritual aspect. We pray together, we have worships. In our course lectures, we emphasize not only the nature of the dinosaurs, but also about the aspects of creation that are important to us all. Because if creation is not a valid account of origins, neither is the sacrifice of Christ a valid account of salvation.
You don't see this every day. I don't care where you're from. From California, like I am, Thailand, Africa, New Zealand, wherever. We have an opportunity to discover history. You're a city girl, city guy, city old guy, city young girl guy, whatever you are. Just come, all right?
Is open-ended. We aren't going to run out of bones anytime in the near future. I will continue to work with it as long as God gives me that ability. So that's just a quick overview of our project, just kind of little vignettes. And now I want to take you through the actual experience of being in the field and what we're doing and why. And mostly I want to talk about the question that so many people have, which is what happened to the dinosaurs? Now, I've talked to people, I even talked to somebody today, I've talked to many people who thought dinosaurs weren't real. I had one girl that came to work for me and in the laboratory, and she was hesitant to work on the dinosaur bones. And I asked her why, and she said, because they're not real. I said, what do you mean they're not real? And she said, well, my teacher told us that the dinosaurs were not real and that she made us look the other way when we went by the skeletons in the museum. So there is absurdity upon absurdity that's gone on in the past, and I want to make sure that doesn't continue into the future, because we know that dinosaurs were real creatures, and in fact, they were amazing creatures. And I hope to expose some of that tonight. The dinosaur we work with mostly is this one right here on the screen, Edmontosaurus annectans, a 30 to 40 foot long animal. This is no dwarf. This duck-billed dinosaur ate plants. It probably lived in or near water. Its strength was in its hips. It had a tail like a cedar tree. Oh, wait a minute. I'm quoting Job, aren't I? I'm not trying to make any point in particular, but that Job does tell us that this creature that's described there, that God is describing, that he calls behemoth, that animal, he said, was the first of the creation of God. So something really big and important on the earth. So I think dinosaurs are not something that we should just ignore or sweep under the carpet. I think there's something that is very important to us to learn about. So as we talk about these dinosaurs tonight, be thinking, what kinds of questions do I have that I'd like to have answers for? And then I'll tell you how you can help answer those questions later on. This is what Edmontosaurus looks like. We have never found an intact Edmontosaurus, but there are two or three of them that have been found by other people that are called mummies, where the whole animal is together, including the skin, and the internal organs are not visible, but the musculature can be imagined on the carcass. They're all there. So if somebody wants to say that scientists are just making up those animals, they're real. And this is how they look, more or less. Another dinosaur we find is called a Blisodon. It's a theropod, a meat-eating dinosaur, at least has carnivorous traits. Nanotyrannus is a dinosaur that there was a video made this summer. Some of you may have seen it on the National Geographic channel of Nanotyrannus. And if you saw it, many of the scenes in that were shot in our laboratory down in Texas. for National Geographic. So this is a really important creature. It's about a 20-foot long animal. It's smaller than T-Rex, but it looks a lot like T-Rex. And the argument was, is this really Nanotyrannus, or is this just a small version of a T-Rex? And they wanted it to be a small version of T-Rex because they don't have any small T-Rexes. And we know that T-Rexes came from eggs about this big. So what happened between the time that egg hatched and we find this giant dinosaur skeleton like Sue at the National Museum in Chicago, Field Museum in Chicago? What happened to all those stages in between this little egg and the thing that hatched out of that egg and this big giant dinosaur? And so that part of the history of T-Rex is not written yet. And so they wanted very much for this dinosaur to fill in those gaps, but they haven't been able to do that because we insist this is a different taxon for good reasons. Dromaeosaurs, those are the raptors. You've probably heard of raptors. Sarnitholeces, another one. Nodosaurus is a giant lumbering beast, and we found the burial site of one of these several years ago, and we've been digging slowly on that. He's covered with inch-thick bone all over his body. So whatever else you want to say about him, he was well protected. And if you look at his legs, you see his legs there. I guess this doesn't show up on the screen, but you see how thick his legs are. That's an animal that's doing what? Digging. Yeah, it looks like an armadillo, doesn't it? I don't know if you have seen armadillos, but armadillos live in the ground, and they can dig like nothing you've ever seen before. They're amazing. But anyway, this dinosaur probably had some of those characteristics. May have dug down in the ground to protect his underbelly and just had his back showing. I don't know. Pachycephalosaurus, the bone-headed dinosaur, had a skull. We have what's probably the largest Pachycephalosaurus skull that's ever been found in our collection. It's about that big, and it's that high, and it's solid bone. It's not a brain. The brain isn't inside that. The brain was underneath it, and it's about the size of a walnut. But this giant skull that you see here in these skeletons, or these casts of skeletons, is just solid bone all the way through. So even though they look intelligent, they really are boneheads. Struthiomimus. Struthius is the genus of ostrich. And this certainly looks like an ostrich. Mimus means mimic or like. So it's an ostrich-like dinosaur. That's what it looks like. We find quite a few bones of that. And this past year, we found several more. Thessalosaurus is a sheep-sized dinosaur. And here's a skeleton of one. And this past summer, we found an intact one. The whole dinosaur is there, except for some of the ancillary parts. Parts of the skull are missing and so on. But a lot of the dinosaurs are still there, and I'll show you a picture of that later on. Triceratops. Last year we dug out a skull of a Triceratops. You know how big the skull is? 7 feet long. From the floor up to here. It weighs probably 500 pounds. And we managed to get it back to the laboratory. You saw some pictures of it in that video. I'll show you some more. Now, this is Truodon, which is a bird. There's Triceratops. Here's Truodon, a bird-sized dinosaur. Tyrannosaurus rex. No Upper Cretaceous site would be complete without a description of T-Rex. T-Rex was a carnivorous dinosaur, as far as we know. In fact, we know for sure that after this summer, we're giving a paper at the Geological Society of America meetings in October, about a bone we found this summer, a whole paper about one bone. It happens to be another theropod, another tyrannosaur-type dinosaur. It's about this much of a leg bone, and it's got tooth marks from a T-Rex on it. So that's something nobody's ever seen before, and so we found it this summer, and we're giving a paper on that at the Geological Society meetings. Here's what T-Rex looks like. By the way, that mouth, could easily take you out in one bite. It's 5 feet, his head is 5 feet long, so it's about this long from the floor. Big, big animal. I mentioned in the description in the video that taphonomy was a science of trying to find out everything that happened to an animal from the time he's alive and walking around until we excavate him from the ground. What was he doing when he died? How did he die? What happened after he died? And what happened after he died? What happened to his bones, and how did they get to be the way they are today? Now, the bones, I'll just tell you now, because most people don't know this unless they've been working on this kind of thing. The bones are really bone. And if I take a piece of that bone and cut through it, make a thin section, that's a piece of bone that's cut very, very thin so you can see all the cells inside. You can still see all the osteocytes there, and it looks just like modern bone, except that it's the colors are a little different because it picks up iron and manganese from the soil, and it loses the protein, so it's not very flexible, and it gains fluoride. And fluoride does what to bone? What? It hardens it. So these bones are very hard, but they're very inflexible. So that means there's danger of breaking them, and that's a problem we have to deal with all the time. What killed the dinosaurs? That's the first part of our puzzle. So to answer this question, we go to the scientists and we ask them what kinds of theories they have for what killed the dinosaurs. And we find out the most popular theory is that an asteroid struck the Earth and it caused a giant conflagration, and that process killed off all the dinosaurs. Well, that's an interesting theory. But how come it killed off all the dinosaurs and all the other reptiles, the other Mesozoic reptiles, but not the crocodiles or alligators or lizards or snakes? And it didn't kill off the mammals. So it's only a partially satisfying explanation. And so many other explanations have been put forward. Some people said the dinosaurs all died because the Earth got too hot. And of course, the antithesis of that, it got too cold and all the dinosaurs died, or it got too dry and the dinosaurs died, or it got too wet and the dinosaurs died, or the dinosaurs ran out of food. And so they all died. And then on the other side, some scientists have suggested they ate too much and died. The new kinds of plants were coming on the Earth, and that killed them off. Poisonous food developed, and dinosaurs died. And one scientist even suggested, and I spare you the picture, that they died of constipation. Of course, all of these are grasping at what? Grasping at straws, because nobody really knows why the dinosaurs died, except I know. I'll tell you in a minute. Some other theories are they died from volcanic activity. An interesting story on the side here about this particular suggestion. A scientist who had a PhD from Stanford University in geology, very well-known and respected geologist, suggested that the current theory of an asteroid impact was incorrect, and instead that the best theory to explain the demise of the dinosaurs was there was massive volcanic activity, volcanic ash was spewed out, and it caused the dinosaurs to die, made the Earth uninhabitable, and the dinosaurs died. Well, the scientist that had suggested an asteroid impact caused the dinosaurs to die wasn't very happy about that. In fact, he was a Nobel laureate. His name was Luis Alvarez. He was a physicist, and he had proposed this theory. And when he heard that the man from Stanford, the other geologist, had suggested it was volcanoes, he went behind this man's back and tried to get him fired from his university position. He tried to keep him from getting his publications accepted in the scientific literature, which is just another form of suicide for a scientist, because if you can't get your papers published, you can't be a scientist, really. And finally, he threatened his life. And this geologist documents all this on his webpage. He's probably retired since I read this, but it shows you that not everything in science is what scientists would have us think about science. Not all scientists are objective all the time, and not all scientists are unbiased all the time, and not all scientists are uninvolved in the outcomes of their experiments. So just keep that in mind. When a scientist says something, that scientist is also a human being. And you have to kind of dissect that answer that you get from a scientist and say, well, how much of this is based on real data and how much of this is based on his ideas? And you have to try to separate that out. And that causes more difficulty for us, as we'll see in the next few lectures. Here's another theory, and this one comes about because the cartoonists always jump on fresh meat. So whenever there's a theory that just has too many explanations, in come the cartoonists, and they add a few more. So here you see the dinosaurs, somebody suggesting that the dinosaur died because they took up smoking. And here I said, this is my favorite one. What really happened to the dinosaurs? There was a global catastrophic flood, and this flood caused the demise of the dinosaurs. Now that makes perfect sense in terms of its explanatory power. It explains why all the dinosaurs died. It explains how they could all die in a very short period of time, at least in terms of the layers, and why there are no more dinosaurs. Because presumably, they looked at that boat and they said, there's just not enough room. We'll wait for the next boat. So that answers a lot of our questions. So we'll leave it there in terms of the explanation for what happened to the dinosaurs for now. And let's talk about our actual research project. We began in 1996, and we have been working every summer during the month of June. And if you'd like to come and join us, we have a website I'll give you later that you can come up there and spend any time from a day to a month working during the month of June. Here is where our site is, right there in the Niobrara County, just across the line in Niobrara County. Niobrara County is the least populated county in the least populated state in the United States. So there are not very many people in Niobrara County. In fact, there are many more cattle than there are people in Niobrara County, a population of somewhere around 25 or 3,500 people. And it's pretty much out in the middle of nowhere, up there in the northeast corner of Wyoming in the Powder River Basin. This is our field station, taken from the air, and we are very, very lucky to have, we are very, very blessed to have this facility. It's probably the best field station, it's the best field station I've ever seen for a paleontology expedition. And we have bathrooms for men and bathrooms for women with hot and cold running water. We have showers. We have a kitchen, fully equipped kitchen. We have a dining room. We have a research lab. And we have storage space out under that tent and a meeting room out under the tent that you see there on the outside. Each year we have between 80, 90, and 116 people. Or what does it say, 133? 133 this year. That's a lot of people. And it's pretty remarkable to me because those 133 people come from all over. We had a scientist from Japan. We had several people from Brazil, from Colombia, from, let's see, where else did we get people from this year? It varies from year to year. From Thailand. So we have people coming from all over the world to this dig site. And it's remarkable. How could we accommodate 91 people? Well, here's a picture of our camp from the air during those few days when we had 91 people. Fortunately, they stayed only for a few days, and then they left, so they got to experience it. And then before we got overwhelmed, they left. So it was a really good experience. And in this group of people, we have we had a group there from Church of Christ who were filming, videoing our activities. We had a group from what's the thing here in Denver? Focus on the Family with Dell. Forgotten his name. Anyway, they came out and they videoed some of our work and spent some time with us. We had a group from Trinity Christian Academy, which is a school down in Dallas, where founded by Tom Landry. It's a very high-class school where people enroll their kids before they're even born to make sure they have a spot there. We had a group from a Seventh-day Adventist Church down in South Texas who came there. That's this group over there on the left-hand side. We had a group from Cedarville University, which is a Baptist, mostly Baptist school in Ohio. We had a group from Loma Linda University. We had something like 10 or 12 PhDs there, scientists working. And we had a lot of students, and we had some people that are there who come every year to direct the project. So we had a really, really good crew, and we had a fantastic time. How could you have 91 people in that little camp that I showed you without having serious problems? Can you imagine that? What about bathrooms? We have just those two bathrooms with one shower each. I mean, what do you do about that? Well, you know what? These kids were the most beautiful Christian kids you'd ever want to see. And they behaved themselves perfectly, and everything went like clockwork, and we got it all taken care of. And after a few days, the population went back down to 40 or 50, and then we were happy to finish out the season. So that's what you can expect if you come out to join us. Certain times, you probably don't want to come. You might not want to be there with 91 people because you won't get the kind of attention you might like. But these guys had a wonderful time. These kids, one of these kids from Dallas, his dad is the head of a electronics company in Dallas. He drove all the way down to where our college is in Keene to thank me for what had happened to his kid when he came out there for those 3 days. I mean, I don't know what it was. He didn't tell me. But he wanted to drive all the way out there to say thank you to me for what had happened to his kid. So I'm telling you, this is a life-changing experience for young people. Because not only do they get to work on dinosaurs, which is awesome by itself, but they are in an environment which is a Christian, growing, thriving environment where Jesus is exemplified in the lives of the people and where we talk about him as a creator God. And that's a pretty cool combination. The weather there is amazing. You just never know what you're going to see. That was a first time in my life I'd ever seen one of those. But it's beautiful. And what is it you don't see that you see a lot of in Colorado? Trees, that's right. You probably won't see a tree the whole time you're there. This was our camp taken last year, just as we were getting ready to leave. We had a rainstorm and then a beautiful double or triple or however many you want to count, and rainbow that just came right over the camp. And so we went out there and dug at both ends. This is our crew. Larry Turner is a geophysicist, astrophysicist, actually. who works in also in geophysics. Art Chadwick, that's me. Justin Woods is in charge of our technology, which is considerable. Then we have some quarry leaders. Kathleen Wilson, she has come every year for 16 years. And she wouldn't dare miss because Justin has 15 and a half years. She has 16 years. And if she didn't come, he'd get ahead of her. So she's not about, I kid you not, her mother died. And she went home for the funeral one day and then came back because she didn't want to get behind. Amy Teague is a high school teacher in Cleburne, Texas. She is a beautiful person, and she is very faithful about upholding the standards of the camp. She's a high school teacher, as I said. She knows how to talk to young kids, and so she's not averse to going to them and telling them to put on something different than what they have on when she needs to. And it's interesting because she's not an Adventist, but she's very respectful of Sabbath. And we do take a break on Sabbath, and we have a worship in camp. And usually all the people that are there participate. It's not obligatory, but they usually participate. And in fact, in the video, the guy that was preaching is a Baptist, and he was doing the sermon for me because I was gone that day. And they had a really good worship service. Ty Connell is another high school teacher. Stephen Gray is a high school principal in Dallas. Keith Snyder's head of the biology department at Southern Adventist University. Zuri Franco is a physician. Erin Maloney down there at the bottom, I had to fake that picture because I didn't have a picture of her. She has a PhD in molecular biology, and she's a quarry leader. She comes out every summer, and that's her recreational break. Rose Weeks is a graduate student in geology, and Michael Harris is a teacher also. This is where we work. This is what it looks like from the air. There's the camp way up there, that dot at the top by site, where it says site is our camp. And this road comes out here about a mile out to where we do the excavation, most of our excavation. We have now almost 20 different sites where we're working. And so we have about half a dozen of them or a dozen are right down in this area. And then the rest of them are widely scattered all over the area. So we have a widespread activities. And that's why we have a four-wheeler now. Because trying to get from one site to another became just too difficult. So we use a four-wheeler when we have to do that and also carry water to some of the remote sites. But there's where our main quarry area is down there at the bottom. This is why we're digging there. Those red dots represent bones on the surface in that area. So you can see we don't really have to look very hard to find a bone. These are the bones I was talking about when I said the ranch owner drove me up onto the mesa, and when I got out of the car, I was walking on dinosaur bones. Can you imagine walking on dinosaur bones? What would that be like? How would you feel about that? I didn't feel very comfortable. And so I said, I was working on fossil whales down in Peru. That sounds pretty exotic, doesn't it? We were doing the taphonomy of fossil whales in Peru, hundreds of thousands of whales, tens of thousands of whales. And I stopped that and started working on this because these bones were being destroyed. And we don't know enough about dinosaurs. And every time a bone was washed away, we were losing data. So as a scientist, I just couldn't stomach that. So I said, okay, I'm going to work on this. I'd resisted working on dinosaurs for years because every time somebody in Colorado finds a dinosaur on their property, they call me or call somebody who calls me and says, will you go dig up this dinosaur? And so I said, no, I'm doing other things. But finally, this got to me, and I had to invest in this project. So in 1996, we started out, and we've been working there ever since. That's almost, must be 20 years this year. So let's go out and look at what it's like in the quarry. We developed techniques very early on in response to a challenge from the paleontologists that had been working there when I came. There was a secular paleontologist that was working the site. He had come to the ranch owner and said, look, I'd like to get a 99-year lease on this property so I can build a permanent field station here and we can come study the bones. And the ranch owner said to the paleontologist, because he had seen that he brought out kids from the local area and was telling them about the dinosaurs and all this, he said, look, I'm a creationist, and I'll give you a lease if you will tell the kids about creation as well as evolution. Well, I tell kids all the time about creation as well as evolution. I have no problem with that. I want my students to know about evolution. Why? If it's not true, why should I tell them about it? How are they going to know if it's true or not true if I don't tell them? I want them to know what evolution says, and I want them to know what creation says so that they can decide which one they're going to believe in. And as I'll point out tomorrow, it's not really the data anyway. It's the philosophy. It's the paradigm. It's the theory that you choose that decides what you're going to believe about it. That's kind of scary because it puts a lot of responsibility on you. You have to make a decision whether you're going to believe in creation or evolution. The data alone will not do it. Did you hear what I said? The data alone will not make you decide whether to believe in creation or evolution. It's the formulation of a solution to the whole picture that tells you why creation has to be the correct explanation. And that formulation is essential to your own salvation. Because if you choose to disbelieve in the creation account, you are throwing out the story in Genesis of Adam and Eve. Is that clear? And if you throw out the account of Adam and Eve in Genesis, you're throwing out the account of the fall. And if you throw out the account of the fall and you go back and try to figure out how we got here and it doesn't involve a perfect creation in a perfect garden in a perfect world of a perfect man, then you're putting the responsibility for sin on who? The Creator. And if God is responsible for sin, you might as well take your Bible and burn it. Because everything in that Bible tells us otherwise. It tells us that God made this world perfect. And it was our decision through our parents, it was our decision to turn away from God that caused and necessitated, in the mind of God, necessitated the death of Jesus. And when Jesus came down to this earth and he died for you and for me, he paid the price for our mistakes. And he has realigned us with God. He brings us back to God. And all that story goes away if we believe that there never was a Garden of Eden in a perfect creation. So that's something to think about. And you have to put that into your equation when you're formulating your belief about origins. That has to be a part of it. So here we are, we're out here on this ranch, and the paleontologist tells the ranch owner he's leaving. He can't tell them about creation because he doesn't believe it. So he's leaving, and he says, this is the last day that science will be done on the Hansen Ranch. And he writes that on his building that he left behind and scribbles it on there in ink or something, or paint it was, that this last day science will be done on Hansen Ranch. Well, so that was a challenge to me because here I am coming in after him and he says no more science is going to be done here, so what am I going to do? I've got to do better science than he ever thought about. So I did a lot of praying and I did a lot of thinking and I brought a astrophysicist out with me and we worked the first year. And during that year, as we were working there in the quarry, and by the way, back in those days, before we started using GPS, the way all quarries worked was the same. You gridded it off with strings, You made a string grid that was a meter square, and you held it over your bone, and then you tried to draw your bone through the meter square so you got all the pieces in the right place. And you had to do that for each bone that you found. After doing that for a season, Dr. Turner said, why don't we use GPS? Well, he didn't know, and I didn't know, that there was GPS that was that accurate. We thought GPS was good to, back then it was 10 meters. Now it's a meter or a few meters, but it's still not enough to use for mapping. So I checked into it, and I found out that, yes, there is a survey-grade GPS that allows you to get accuracies in the centimeter and sub-centimeter range. And it involves two parts. The first part is this base station you see here. That white pedestal holds a GPS base, and the GPS base reads the satellites, and the satellites tell it where it is, and it says, the satellites say, well, he's over here. You're over here. But it knows where it actually is. So it says, okay, it was off by 2.3 meters in that direction. And then it broadcasts that through that antenna up there on a radio. It broadcasts that over the whole area where we're working. And at the other end, we have another one of these units, just like that one. It reads those same satellites. It calculates its position. And then it applies the correction factor from the base. And the accuracies are phenomenal. This is a square that's 1/4 inch on a side, about a centimeter on a side, and there are 10 points that I took on one spot inside that 1 centimeter square. So we have accuracies in the sub-centimeter range. That means I can easily map a bone with some points from this system. So we started using that system in the year 2000, and we developed the technology for mapping bones using GPS. When we find a bone in the ground, we bring the GPS in, we clean it off, and then bring the GPS in and take a series of points on the bone. And then those go directly into the computer, so there's no errors being made in the processing. Then we take a picture of the bone and extract the dirt from around the bone and just physically take it away in the Photoshop or some other software, and then we take that bone and orient it to the points and pin it there. So now that bone is registered in 3D space in the exact position that it was really occupied in the ground. Isn't that cool? I would take credit for that myself, but I couldn't have done it without God having given a lot of help. And I won't elaborate on what that help was, but we figured out a lot of things along the way. And we were able to do this using software that was available, a GIS software, and using the GPS data points. So from the year 2000 on, we began to map our bones just like this. And here we have put in the bones around that femur so that you can see what it looks like reconstructed in the ground with the dirt removed. So this is exactly the way that bone looked in the ground with the other bones around it with the dirt gone. Isn't that amazing? So let me show you an example here. Let's go to this first quarry there, quarry number one, that's North Quarry. And we'll just start in 1999 because that's when we started. Actually, we started in 2000, but 1999 I went back and I manually interpreted the points from the grids that we used. And found out where they were, and so I could do it for 1999. And then 2000, 2001, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and you're the first people to see 15. So that's... those dots, red dots, are 1 meter. So it's probably 20 meters square or something like that. That's a lot of bones. So you see, when we go to dig, we don't have to worry about whether somebody's going to find a bone. We bring you in and put you down on a spot and say, dig here, you're going to find 30 bones. You're going to find 1/10 of a dinosaur every square meter that you dig. That's the average that we get out of these quarries. That's North Quarry. I won't go through the steps with the others, but here's another quarry. This is called South Quarry. And that's what it looks like. So it's the same density of bones. Interestingly, everything on the right side has not been excavated yet. Everything on the left side is washed away. It was lost before we got there. So what you're seeing here is the full extent of what we have excavated, plus the full extent of what's not excavated yet beyond that. Here's another quarry. This is number 8 and number 4. And you can see the density there is just the same. This area to the left-hand side hasn't been excavated yet. The right-hand side has been eroded away. So it's going to continue to go like this as you move to the left. And here's one more quarry I'll show you just because of human interest. This is the quarry where the Nanotyrannus was found. The Nanotyrannus that is so important that National Geographic came to our little punk school in Central Texas and brought in a paleontologist, a world-renowned paleontologist, to show these bones and to make that video that they showed back in June. And that's his bones there that are circled. That's what the jaw looks or the skull looks like of Nanotyrannus. Here is the upper jaw that we found. Here I'll tell you another story. I'm telling these stories tonight because I feel free to talk. I mean, I'm not under any deadline. I don't see a clock anywhere. And so I'm going to tell you some interesting stories that I normally wouldn't tell. This one is really interesting because it's still going on. Back in about 2004, we had the largest collection of dinosaur bones on the internet. We did. That had pictures of all the bones. The only one that had pictures of all the bones. So I went to a website on the internet that is sponsored by the U.S. government, run by Berkeley, California, University of California, Berkeley, and purports to have a collection of all the websites on the internet that have anything to do with fossils. It's called paleoportal.com.net. And PaleoPortal says that it has all the websites that have anything to do with fossils. So I thought, well, we should tell them about our website because we have the largest collection of dinosaur bones, the only collection that has pictures of all the bones. They ought to be really interested in this, huh? Wouldn't you guess? So I told them about the site, and I got a note back the next day saying that they would, they had accepted it and it would be up and running. And then I looked for it for about a week. I lost an eye looking for it. And finally, I wrote them again. I said, I can't find it. Where did you put it? And they said, oh, did we tell you that we had accepted it? We weren't supposed to say that. It's still out for review. And I said, okay, well, I don't know what the review process is. By the way, Joe Smith's website that has a picture of a bone is on their website, is on PaleoPortal. All you have to do is have a website with a picture of a bone and they'll put it on there. But here I have the largest collection of dinosaur bones on the internet, the only one that has pictures of all the dinosaur bones. And I advertise it to them and they say, well, it's out for review. Well, after 3 months, they wrote me back and said it had been rejected because it was neither educational nor scientific. Well, I knew what was going on. It's no secret. They know I'm a creationist. I've never made a secret of that. You look on the internet under creationist, you're going to find my name. And that's because that's what I am. I don't represent myself as anything else. And when I go to scientific meetings, people know that I'm a creationist. I don't have to broadcast it. I don't have to make noise. They know. And the evidence they know is right there in this experience with PaleoPortal. Well, it made me mad. I don't get mad very easily. Is that right, Josh? I don't get mad very easily, but when I get mad, I'm going to do something. So I went back and I built a site that was completely educational. had nothing to do with creation. It was just about the dinosaurs. And I put that up, and it's still available, although right now it's been handicapped by some computer glitch that we're trying to work on. It's called dinosaurs.swau.edu, and it's a lot of fun. You can go and check the dinosaurs you want and click on it. It'll take you to a page about it and so on. Well, that wasn't enough. I wanted to do more. So I took all the dinosaur bones that I had, and we went back and started making three-dimensional virtual reality images for each bone. And we built an apparatus that allows us to take 32 pictures while the bone rotates automatically, and then those pictures are uploaded to the computer. We run it through Photoshop and then load them on the internet, and it makes this image on the fly. And you can take your mouse and you can rotate the image, you can zoom into it, and it's a lot of fun. It ends up looking something like this. This is actually just a movie of what it does, but it'll show you what it does. So you can see it turn all the way around, and you can zoom into any part of it and take a closer look. See if you can find that anywhere on Paleo Portal. See if you can find it on the Smithsonian site. See if you can find it on University of Chicago site. See if you can find it on the Berkeley site. We are the only site on the internet that has dinosaur bones with three-dimensional virtual reality images of all the bones. That means that you can look at that bone from your seat in your house, and you can look at it up close and find out what it really looks like if you want to. You don't have to come to the college and look at it. You can do it from home. Furthermore, we made it possible, I don't have an image of this, unfortunately, we made it possible so that you can click on a map function, and on the map function, you can go and see where that bone was in the quarry, exactly where that bone was found with all the other bones around it. Nobody else can do that. And the reason we did this is because we want to make sure that if I die, when I die, all this data isn't gone. If I die before Jesus comes back, I want this data to be available to other people. And so I've showed them exactly where each bone is found. You click on the map, and it will show you a map of that particular quarry with that particular bone highlighted so you can see it. So that's what we did when I got mad. This is the lower jaw of that dinosaur. This is the Triceratops we found, the skull that we took out last year. And this is the back of the skull right here facing us. And I'll show you another picture. Here's one of the horns. Here's the two horns out in the front of the skull. There's the whole skull. Here we are casting it out. And that's me lying there on the ground underneath it, trying to get some plaster to stick up over my head. That's a lot of fun. And we put a pallet inside the cast so that the whole thing was cast to a pallet. Then we turned it over, and the pallet was on the bottom. And we're down in a hole. We're down in a four-foot hole here, so we had to get it out of that hole. And it weighs about 1,000 pounds. We had about 400 pounds of plaster on it, plus all the wood. And so it weighed about close to 1,000 pounds. And so we had it turned on this on the pallet. So we slid it over to the edge. We built a ramp. We attached the truck to it, and we pulled it up the ramp and pushed on it and pulled it up the ramp. We got it up on top of the ground. Now we had to get it in the bed of the pickup truck. So we dug holes in the ground, dropped the wheels of the truck down to make it as low as possible, built a ramp up into the bed, and then with a four-wheeler, we pushed on it, and there were five or six of us big guys there, and we would just push as hard as we could, and finally we got it up into the bed of the truck. And that was, of course, on the last day we were there, so we didn't have any choice. We had to get it out, and we did. Here it is back in the laboratory, and you can see the back of the frill is at the back there and the two horns sticking out the front. The nose is off it here. It's over on a table somewhere. And here's a map of that quarry. And do you see where the Triceratops is there? This, by the way, is a map nobody else has seen also. This is our Triceratops II quarry. And off on the right there, you see those bones, that pile of bones on the right-hand side? We found, that same year we took out the Triceratops, we found those bones down in the front, the kind of brownish ones, and they were these right here, these three vertebrae and one toe bone and a femur. Those are all from a different dinosaur called Thessalosaurus that I showed you a picture of earlier. It's that sheep-sized dinosaur. Well, that was what we found last year. So we decided this year we're going to go back and dig in that site again. And we found the whole animal. And here you can see its backbone. See it laid out there with the sacrum and the ribs off on the top part there. And it's being excavated very carefully. And it's back in our workshop now. And we're trying to piece it back together. And that's a lot of work. And you wonder, well, why didn't God give us a quarry with a bunch of dinosaurs all put together? We wouldn't have known what to do with it when we started out. But now we're learning. We've taken out a Triceratops skull. That's the most challenging thing you can do. We got it back in one piece. We've taken out, now we've started work on a whole skeleton of something. Who knows what God will have for us next year? But we have developed the competence. We have a crew. Believe it or not, you saw 12 years, 16 years, 14 years. These people are all going to be there next year. And so this crew has worked together every summer for all these years, and they know what they're doing. And that's a remarkable thing that God has done for us. Well, we're back to taphonomy now. We're going to try and understand what happened to these dinosaurs and whether they died in a flood or whether they died some other way. And here we have some taphonomic information. The standard explanation for what happened to the dinosaurs in bone beds like this one, and this explanation has been applied to these bones, is that the dinosaurs were crossing a stream, a river, during flood stage, and some of them drowned and were carried downstream to a creek in the river, and they caught there, and year after year, these bones accumulated there. And that's why we have, how many dinosaurs did he say? 10,000? The bones of 10,000 dinosaurs. Is that the correct model? Let's take a look at the data. Number one, the bones lack current orientation. That is, if they were in a river, you would expect them to be oriented by the flow of the river. These bones don't show that. They show orientation all over the map. Here you can see, all I did here was just for fun. I dragged some of the bones together, just whatever their orientation was, and put them into a diagram. And you can see those bones are not oriented. They're disoriented. Number two, the bones are mostly disarticulated. That means they aren't skeletons. That's really important because if they were carried downstream and caught in a creek in the river, they're still skeletons, aren't they? These are all disarticulated bones, which means they aren't joined together anymore, just like the bones in Ezekiel, right? And so the horizontal distribution is random. Here you can see the ribs. And this is something we can do because we have all this information in the computer. We can say, ribs, show up. And just the ribs will pop up. That's not that easy, but you get the idea. So we can look, because our data is all digital, we can pull up any combination of data we want and look at it. And here you can see the ribs are not looking like a rib cage. They're looking like randomly distributed bones. Bones are in a normal graded bed. Now, a normal graded bed means big things at the bottom and little things at the top. That's normal grading. Big things at the bottom, little things at the top. And here is the evidence for that. This is probably the most important thing I'm going to tell you tonight. And I want you to challenge the data if you feel like it. Here is the bottom 2 decimeters. That's this much. The lowest part of the bone bed. And what do you see? Big bones. You can't tell yet because I didn't put a scale in it. It's my fault. Okay, those are the big bones. These are smaller, the next 2 decimeters. These are smaller, next 2 decimeters. And these are smallest of all, next 2 decimeters. So it's going from big to small. That means The only explanation that will work for this bone bed is that all the bones were brought there in one single event. They were catastrophically emplaced. Now that's good news for somebody that believes in a catastrophic flood, because you have a mechanism for putting the bones in place. Now, we have a problem too, don't we? Because those dinosaurs had to rot somewhere before they could be catastrophically emplaced in this graded bed. And that requires time. Furthermore, we find out as we look through these quarries and we dig out the bones, we find lots and lots of shed theropod teeth. Now, theropods, for those of you who don't know, the kids all know, but you adults might not know, theropods are meat-eating dinosaurs, carnivorous dinosaurs. They are serrated edges, just like a steak knife, for cutting through meat. And those dinosaurs have teeth that fall out every once in a while. They break off when they hit a bone, because they probably go like that. And if they hit a bone, it breaks the tooth off. And then they grow a new one. So throughout their lives, unlike us, throughout their lives, they can grow new teeth. We have to take care of ours because we don't get to do that. But the dinosaurs could be careless and just take a bite, and if they broke off a few teeth, no big deal. They'd grow them back. But that means they leave teeth behind when they feed. And when we look through these bones in the quarries, we find lots of these shed theropod teeth. Now, what does that tell me? It tells me that while these animal carcasses were sitting there, rotting, other dinosaurs were wandering around trying to find food, which makes sense during a global flood. And typically, if you have wolves and sheep, which ones are going to die first? Sheep are, yeah, that's right. The sheep are going to die first. So if we have sheep dinosaurs like duck-billed dinosaurs that ate plants, and we have wolf dinosaurs like theropods that ate meat, which ones are going to die first? The sheep dinosaurs are going to die first. And so that's what we see, is these dinosaurs died, and then the carnivorous dinosaurs came along and they started eating these decaying carcasses. And you might think, oh, that's gross. Well, it is for you. But what does your dog do with a bone when you give it to him and he goes out in the backyard? What does he do? He buries it, that's right. And then 3 weeks later or 3 months later, what's he do? Dig it up and eat it. Now, if you tried to do that, what would happen? You'd probably die, that's right. But these animals can tolerate those kinds of things. And so they were eating these animals probably because they didn't have anything else to eat. And so we find their shed teeth among these carcasses. And the carcasses have lots of broken bones in them. And so these animals died. They were disarticulated by rotting and probably by giant T-Rexes stomping around on them trying to get something to eat. And after they sat for a few weeks, though, that whole mass of bones, broken bones, whole bones, carcasses were all picked up and transported downstream in a catastrophic deposit called a debris flow. And debris flows move very fast, and they produce a graded bed with big things on the bottom and little things on the top, just like we see. Well, if that's the correct explanation for the bone bed, then what isn't the correct explanation? That they died crossing a river and drowned and got carried downstream year after year after year. That is not the correct explanation. And so what we have accomplished so far, I better show you some bones, hadn't I? Okay, this is the way the bones look after they've been cleaned up. There's a femur on the bottom. Notice it's about a meter and a half long, about 5 feet long. The one on the top is a foot bone, and it's about half a meter long, 3 feet, 2 feet long. and that other bone there. So they're very well preserved. And we estimate that we have somewhere, a conservative estimate, about 5,000 of these animals. 5,000 animals each, 30 feet long, 20 to 30 feet long. That is a large amount of material. Let's just take a look at how much there is. This is a map of the area with the bones highlighted in white. And we're going to go zoom in on these quarries. And the black area is down to where the bones are, and the orange-yellow area is above the bones, and the red area is below the bones. So let's just strip off all that other part. And now we can take those quarries and use them as paintbrushes to paint it in to see what it would look like if we had it all dug up. And that's what it would look like. That's how many bones we have. So how do we know how many dinosaurs we have? Well, we take 1 square meter, we calculate how many dinosaurs are in that 1 square meter, and then we calculate how many square meters we have, and we find out what our minimum number of dinosaurs is. And depending on what square meters you count, we get between 5 and 10,000 or more animals from this deposit. So are we going to run out in my lifetime? No, nowhere near. I mean, if all of you came out and helped me, maybe, but not likely. There's enough dinosaurs here for generations to come. Let's just skip over that. We also look at little things that we find in the dirt around the bones. A lot of different things. These are shark's teeth up there in the upper left. And fish teeth in the next column, and at the bottom are crocodile teeth. All of these are tiny, tiny, tiny little things. That head of that pin, that little gold circle you see there, is 1 millimeter across, about like that. So those are tiny, tiny little bones. The next column has shark, has skate and ray teeth, like stingrays. And at the bottom are those little dinosaurs called Truodon that I showed you, the bird-sized dinosaurs. And then on the right-hand side, there's some shark's teeth at the top, a shark's tooth, and then a dermal denticle. Dermal denticles are interesting. They used to use shark's skin for sandpaper. Back before they had good sandpaper, they would just take some shark's skin and use it to smooth the furniture off and make a nice smooth finish. That's what makes shark's skin rough, is those little bony pieces in it. And at the very bottom are teeth from mammals. There are some mammals in these deposits also. We find plants. These are pollen grains from plants that we dug out of one of the quarries. Those are very small. That little bar there is 30 millionths of a meter across. So these are about 20 or 30 microns. And then we find lots of other things. Let's go down here to our model. This is the model we propose, is that these dinosaurs died catastrophically. They died either from drowning or they died from suffocation, are the two best explanations we have. Drowning, meaning that they were trapped in water and couldn't breathe, couldn't keep their heads above water. Maybe they were dog paddling in the water until they couldn't stay up anymore. Don't know. But that's one possibility, is they died from drowning. Now they're out in water. What's going to happen when they die? What happens? These are plant-eating dinosaurs. What do they have in their stomachs? Lots of plants. And what's the plant going to do in its stomach? It's going to ferment. And when it ferments, it's going to produce gas. And when it has gas in the stomach, it's going to rise to the surface. So here you have this sea covered with the carcasses of these drowned dinosaurs. And eventually what's going to happen? The wind's going to come along and blow them up on the shoreline, and they're going to get stranded there, and they're going to sit there for a while and rot. Then this, let's say another volcanic event or an earthquake or something happens and resuspends that sediment, and the whole mass of sediment is transported out into the basin as a single catastrophic event. And that's as far as we have taken this story. We don't have the ultimate answers. We don't expect in science to ever have ultimate answers. You know where ultimate answers come from? Do you remember Pilate asked Jesus that question? What is truth? And where was truth? Standing right in front of him. God is ultimate truth, and he has ultimate truth. And someday he will explain anything that we need to know to us. But until then, this is the best we can do. Science is the best we can do. It's a tool for finding out about the natural world around you. And if you're a young person and you're thinking about what kind of career you'd like to have, and you want to do something that's fun and exciting and interesting and will also pay your bills, go into science. Science is great. It's a great place to find out about the world that God created and make a living doing it. So that's my story, and I hope that you've enjoyed hearing it tonight. This unusual, very rich deposit of dinosaurs in eastern Wyoming is opening a window into the past that's allowing us to see some things for the first time that nobody else has ever seen before. Now, why didn't somebody else discover these bones were in a graded bed? Why didn't somebody else notice this? It turns out that other sites are in graded beds too. And you know what happened? The other scientists said, oh, our bones are like that too, after they saw that we had discovered it. And in a book on taphonomy, or in a paper where they discussed their bones being in a graded bed, they cited our paper in their bibliography, but they never referred to it in the paper. Isn't that interesting? Why did they do that? Because they didn't want to refer to creationists. But we were the ones that discovered this, and why did we discover it? Not because we're smarter, not because we're brilliant. We discovered it because we had our eyes open and God put something in front of us that we couldn't ignore. Was it in front of all these other people too? Yes. But their model did not enable them to see something that we saw. Their search image was different than ours. And as a result, we were able to find things that nobody else found. Isn't that neat? So that's one of the rewards we have for having an open mind. Being able to look at things that other people don't look at is that we can make discoveries in science that other people will miss. And that's pretty exciting. Thank you very much. Here's some websites you can go through to if you're interested in learning more. Origins.swau.edu is all about evolution creation and the conflict between the two. The second one, the Dinosaur Museum, is where you can see those 3D images of all these bones. The third one is that dinosaur website that's partially functional. It's worth going to, but it doesn't all work yet. And the fourth one is if you want to come and participate in the project in the month of June next year or any time in the future, that's where you want to go to find out about it. So take a picture of that or take a look at those websites and keep that in mind as a resource for you in the future. Yes? Wait. Okay, go ahead. You were first.
What's the closest plausible explanation that you've heard why the dinosaurs all ended up in the area they did, that you don't get information that contradicts each other?
One of the commonly posited scenarios is that they ran out of water. And so the dinosaurs all gathered at a watering hole, and then the water ran out and they died. It's silly, but that's commonly suggested. The other is that a whole herd was killed by a meteoric impact. And I don't know how that would do that, but that's what they suggest. Maybe it would be a result of concussion or something. But not many people think about that. Well, no, it's, yeah, you're right. It's too catastrophic. How do you kill 20,000 dinosaurs? I don't know. Your question. What's that? To come and look doesn't cost anything. If you're going to stay there and participate, there's a daily fee for participation, a daily fee if you're living there with us. And those are all laid out on that site. You can. Yeah. Yeah, that's an ongoing project. We have a couple of people working on our bones right now. I can't say yes or no to that. But there aren't hundreds of them. There are a few examples in the literature. There probably are more people that have looked, and they may not have reported it. But I would say that's a developing story. I'll say more about that tomorrow. Any other questions? Yes. Well, if you're looking at an evolutionary explanation, you'd have to go with which dinosaur do you mean, because the evolutionary scenario has these dinosaurs living before these dinosaurs and so on. Personally, I think they were on the Earth from the beginning, from creation, and that what we see is their catastrophic destruction during the flood. Yes. You mean like lions and tigers and bears and they're huge. They're huge, but you ask any kid what he'd choose for a pet, what does he want? He wants a patasaurus, a brontosaurus. He doesn't want a dog or cat. He wants a dinosaur. Why? Because they're the most awesome thing there is. And if you read the story in Job, that God is talking. And God is describing this beast behemoth. And for my money, there's nothing else on the earth that matches the description. It's walking on its rear legs, its strength is in its hips, and it's got a tail like a cedar tree, and it eats grass like an ox, which these did. So it lives in the waters, in the fens, and it's the first of the creation of God. To me, it's one of those things God made. I think we're going to see dinosaurs in heaven. If you don't like it,
so with carbon dating, they still can't trace how many years they've been on the Earth.
We'll talk about dating tomorrow afternoon if you can come, but okay. I just should not open that until I have to. But yeah, they don't know. They can't directly date the bones. Yes. I hadn't planned on it, but we can talk about it. Why don't we do that tomorrow in question and answer? I'll be glad to discuss it. Yes. Yes. Okay, this is one of the major misconceptions that people have about dinosaurs. The things that swam and the things that flew are not dinosaurs. They are reptiles, but not dinosaurs. And so that doesn't change your question. I just wanted to make that clarification. Pterodactyls and pterosaurs are not dinosaurs. They don't have the requisite characteristics of dinosaurs, but they are reptiles. And the ichthyosaurs and the other animals that lived in the water, they are not dinosaurs either. The only thing that are dinosaurs are animals that had a particular kind of hip joint and some other characteristics, but that's the main one. And the question is, why did they die? And that's a wonderful question. It's one that I hope we can have an answer for someday, but we don't right now. Because some things died in the ocean, and a lot of things didn't. A lot of things survived in the ocean. Some things died on land, and other things didn't. And we don't know the reason why this is. And so that's an unanswered question. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. I hope you can come tomorrow and hear some more.